Welcome to episode 22 of the Kevin Ruck Show. Today's conversation is with Elise Killeen, who is the founding partner at a Bitcoin venture capital firm called Stillmark. In our conversation, we discussed exactly why Elise is excited about investing in Bitcoin companies. We discussed her investing process, the kinds of companies she's looking for, the types of founders she likes to back, the process in which she makes decisions. We also discussed some of the Bitcoin adoption recently. Specifically, we covered the Lightning Network, some of the interesting applications that Elise sees there. We discussed payments. We discussed Web3. Overall, this is a great conversation if you are an investor or interested in investing in Bitcoin companies. If you're enjoying the show and you want to support it, the best way you can do that is by sending in sats over the Lightning Network. You can also send in comments and questions. I read every single one and appreciate all of the listeners who are sending in sats. Just a quick shout out before we get into the episode. Today's show is sponsored by Voltage. Voltage is the premier provider of Bitcoin and Lightning node infrastructure. You can hear about them more at voltage.cloud, and we'll have more from Voltage later in the show in the Lightning round. Elise, thank you for coming on the show today. Maybe we can start with your background in Bitcoin. Can you tell me about your process of learning about what Bitcoin is, studying it, and then going on to create Stillmark?
Of course. So I came into Bitcoin in 2013, which was a year after I had started in the venture capital field. And so I had been coming from the mind frame of someone that was looking at frontier technologies like cloud networking or cybersecurity technologies, machine learning. And from that, I found Bitcoin in 2013 and really decided then that it was probably the best use of my time to learn more and to figure out what was going on. And so I became an active conference participant, an audience member. And through that, I was able to meet founders, the earliest founders in the space, folks working at a protocol level, you know, really foundational teams to the ecosystem like a Blockstream, and all of that carries us forward to where we are today, which is that Stillmark exists as a venture firm to support founders building in the Bitcoin and Lightning and Layer 2 spaces. And we're the first firm to do so, of course. We launched in 2019.
Awesome. Was there any particular moment on that journey where you realized Bitcoin was a big deal, or was it kind of a natural progression over time?
So I realized that it was, you know, that it should be a big deal and that I hoped that it would. And the reason for that was that I saw Bitcoin as an opportunity for democratizing financial tools and allowing people to engage without being gated with a global economy for the first time. And so, of course, there were risks in Bitcoin's adoption and in Bitcoin getting to the point that we are today. But by the time we got to, by the time SegWit was activated, I thought that the worst of those risks were behind us and that Bitcoin was itself relatively de-risked in terms of Bitcoin as a new infrastructure, a new protocol technology.
Makes sense. Now, you're hyper-focused on Bitcoin. And I think there are a number of funds that are also hyper-focused on Bitcoin, but I think it, broadly speaking, there's a lot that have dabbled and are just maybe not entirely focused on this. What do you see that other funds are missing right now? Like what makes you so entirely focused on Bitcoin, whereas others are investing in artificial intelligence and AR and VR and other tech, you know, different parts of the tech ecosystem?
Well, there's the ecosystem is undercapitalized. So just from a capitalistic perspective and an opportunity to make returns for our investors, there's less money in the Bitcoin ecosystem than there are strong opportunities to back founders. And so it doesn't really make sense. And because our network is so strong in the space, we can help founders you know, accelerate their vision by making connections for them, by, you know, by allowing them to benefit from the lessons that we've learned ourselves in the past. I think that our opportunity is really to be quite heads down on Bitcoin, But that said, I think of us as a Bitcoin, as a generalist fund that has a specific knowledge and insight in the Bitcoin space and a specific network in the Bitcoin and Lightning space. I suppose my expectation would be that all of the sectors that you mentioned will eventually have overlap with Bitcoin. So you mentioned VR, and for instance, I can imagine one day that in virtual reality gaming that you might see sats exchanged. Certainly AI already has applications in the Bitcoin and Lightning space. And that's the reason why I think of us as a generalist fund with a really special opportunity and a special advantage. And on the flip side of that, I acknowledge the initial premise of your question, which was that there are generalist funds that are dabbling in Bitcoin. And we actually love to work with those funds. And the reason for that, so here's an example, Kraft Ventures. So Brian Murray at Kraft Ventures is a really special, brilliant investor that Stillmark has partnered with on a variety of deals, including Lightning Labs. And I think that Kraft brings so much to the table by the virtue of what they see in deploying capital across fields. So a lot of what venture capital can do, I think that, maybe is not obvious to all founders. And I hope through your podcast can become more obvious to Bitcoin founders, is that VCs, I think, are just there really to help accelerate founders' vision. And that generally doesn't mean, there's no sort of VCs are not there to like lead the way, right? They're there to back up strong founders that can lead their company in a manner that, in my case, advances Bitcoin and creates enterprise value with their own company. And so a lot of what can help founders in executing that is just the no-to of building a company. How do you capitalize your company in a healthy way? What sort of capital is healthiest for your company at various stages? How do you build a team? How do you sort of upgrade and mature your org structure? All things like that, which are the same, almost the same in Bitcoin as there are in other spaces. Now, in Bitcoin, of course, we have to pay attention to other things that you might not in AI. So most important is that when you're building in the Bitcoin space, what you're building has to make sense for Bitcoin and for the protocol itself, right? So a great example of this is that in 2014, a lot of investment went into merchant payment processor tech. And of course, that didn't really make sense until Lightning was introduced, adopted, and was scalable. So merchant payment processing at Bitcoin, the core protocol, wasn't something that made sense. And we knew that even in 2014, because it was something discussed as early as 2009 in the cypherpunk groups. So for Bitcoin VCs, even if you're a generalist investing in Bitcoin, it's important to understand the unique nature of the protocol technologies and also what can be done with those technologies and what the limitations are and why the limitations exist.
Right. And I guess there's even another element for Bitcoin investors or people investing in Bitcoin companies is that there's also a protocol that can be invested in. Whereas like, for Web 2 in this kind of like social media era, there was no like, you couldn't just buy internet stock. You have to buy a particular company, whereas there's an option now. You could buy the protocol or you can buy equity in a company. How do you make that decision? How do you, when you're talking with investors, how do you pitch them on why it's important to invest in Bitcoin companies versus the Bitcoin protocol?
Well, I would think that the best way to participate in the space for institutions, endowments, family offices is to both hold Bitcoin, which I think you're implying is an investment in the protocol, and to back Bitcoin companies. And the way I think about Stillmark's work is that if our investment work is successful and we're truly backing and also helping to accelerate founders that are building the right companies in the space, then that will be positively correlated with the increase in Bitcoin's fundamental value. And the reason for that is because the sorts of founders that we work with are often helping to drive adoption, creating breadth in Bitcoin's utility or in Lightning's utility, and making Bitcoin, hopefully a more valuable asset to a broader audience. And so I think the best way to benefit from this sort of private sector activity is not just to back the companies, but also to hold Bitcoin. And if you're holding Bitcoin and you're a family office or an institution, and you can also back the companies, they're, the Amazons and, PayPal's, eBay's of the world are being built now in the Bitcoin space. And so it's quite an exciting time to be participating in VC in this field.
Are there any particular applications right now that you're seeing, like you mentioned, the Amazons, the PayPals of Bitcoin are being built? Any particular verticals where you think the next era of tech giants will come from?
Well, so we're investing right now in two different buckets. So first, we're looking at companies that help financialize the Bitcoin ecosystem and take advantage of Bitcoin Core Protocol's principal qualities. And so an example of that would be a company like Casa, where it's making multisig something that's more broadly available. So multisig, of course, is inherent. Anyone can sort of use multisig with or without Casa. That's a part of Bitcoin. But what Casa does is it makes it easy. It provides a nice dashboard, a nice UI, UX experience. And then on top of that, puts a sophisticated customer service function. And so it means that you don't have to be a back-end developer in order to make use of Bitcoin's multisig properties. And what that does is it helps us realize one of Bitcoin's core promises, which is that you can be your own bank. And so a company like Casa would fit in that first bucket. Other sorts of interesting opportunities could be maybe a proof of reserve, things like that. Or things that advance trading mechanics on Bitcoin or Lightning. In the second bucket, I think of that as our moonshot bucket. And so that's where we're investing in second or third layer infrastructures, where we're looking at companies that are built on top of that. And so an example now, I'll reference back to merchant payment processing. It didn't make sense in 2014. But now in 2022, when Lightning has matured to the state that it can support, Bitcoin is legal tender in El Salvador, for example, merchant payment processing makes a lot of sense. And so we're looking at opportunities like that. Whatever sort of application can find value in free and nearly instant global payment capabilities, that's an application that can use Bitcoin. And so that means that we're looking in sectors like gaming, social chat, areas like that.
Interesting. So that first bucket, financialization of Bitcoin, do you view that as trying to get more, basically to get more investors into the space holding the asset through some of these services, like if it's multisig or if it's proof of reserves, ways to improve that onboarding experience for people holding Bitcoin?
It's allowing the opportunities of Bitcoin to be unlocked for a broader user base. And so if dad, if mom, if uncle and auntie can all sort of, be able to fully participate in Bitcoin to be their own bank or to engage in a custodian in a safe way, for instance, through proof of reserves or in a safer way, those are the sorts of companies that we're backing in the first bucket. But then it also could be things like, can you use Bitcoin as collateral to recognize a loan or to access a loan? Things like this. So it's creating a new financial ecosystem around what Bitcoin can innately do.
And are those two buckets for you relatively balanced, or do you view are you more heavily weighted towards that first bucket and have a smaller kind of moonshot portfolio? What's that balance look like? And maybe does it shift over time?
It does shift over time. So right now, our expectation is that 2022 is going to be a really important year for payments. And I imagine that that's not news to you, and probably you agree with this. And so in preparation for that, our portfolio has gotten, pretty weighted towards the layer two application side. And so for instance, very recently, we've made investments in Voltage, in Amboss space, in a gaming company called Pink Frog that is looking to integrate Lightning payments into their social mobile game. And so all of those were done both because the founders were just so incredibly, undeniably exceptional, but also because we wanted to prepare the portfolio for a big year for Lightning in 2022. And then I imagine that when we're done investing, my expectation is the portfolio will have something between 15 and 20 companies. When we get to that 20 companies, the portfolio will probably be pretty balanced between those two buckets.
What makes 15 or 20? Why is that the right number? How do you kind of think about how big that portfolio should be?
Well, it's limited. Okay, so there's a lot of variables that go into this. So you're asking a question about portfolio construction, and that would be a whole session. But it's important to look at how much activity is happening in the space and, how many companies. When Stillmark is investing, we're investing in a company because we think it has a chance to accrue an enterprise value in the billions of dollars, $1 billion or more. And so we have to look at the landscape and see how many of those companies we expect to have an opportunity to back within a 2 to 4 year period, a fund cycle. And so that's part of it. But then it's also, of course, we have constraints. So the fund size would be a constraint. How many investment team members you have can sometimes be a constraint. What the rest of the investing ecosystem looks like. You kind of almost asked this question before. So a company, of course, Stillmark can't serve, all the advisory needs of a company. And so we have to make sure that where we can't, that there's other really strong investors there to be collaborative. And so all of these sorts of things go into informing our development of a portfolio construction model. And that affects our investments.
Okay, very cool.
That's typical of venture capital. So that's not specific to Stillmark or Bitcoin. So a traditional VC firm will have an idea of what their portfolio will look like even before they start making their initial investments. And so something that is important for founders here and a question that founders can ask is, does your portfolio model include follow-on capital? So if you write me a check today in my seed round, should I expect you to also invest in my Series A round? And so for us, for Stillmark, we do. That's part of our construction model. So we have both this initial investment we make, and then we'll set aside capital so that we can continue to support founders over the long term of their company financially.
Right. And when you mentioned a fund cycle, like 2 to 4 years, what exactly does that pertain to? Is that the time between different rounds or the time that you expect a company to get to that $1 billion range? What is that 2 to 4 years?
So the time that it takes a company to be ready for a significant acquisition or for the public markets can be like 10 to 12 years from the time that they take their seed financing. It can be even longer than that. So, and we're very patient. So we're always partnering with founders, not expecting a quick flip. So this is also different. This is also a way that Bitcoin venture capital or venture capital is different from altcoin sort of like hedge funds or altcoin investment practices where they do expect that really quick flip. And when you're investing in equity versus tokens, you can't expect that quick flip because the value of the equity that you're investing in is tied to the enterprise value of the company. And so, of course, when you're investing in tokens, that's entirely different. The token's value is not in any discernible way tied to the value, enterprise value of the company that has issued the token. But in Stillmark's case, we're investing in Bitcoin companies and Lightning. So that means equity investments. Now, you asked about the 2 to 4 year cycle. What I mean by that is the period within which a particular fund is deploying initial capital. So making brand new investments. that generally, so traditionally that was a 4-year cycle. And in the past, maybe, I don't know, 3 to 4 years, the cycle has been compressed to 2 to 3 years. And then VCs will go back out to market to raise another fund. After that 2 to 4 years expires, though, the fund could still be investing, but that would be in those follow-on checks that I talked about, where maybe you invested in a pre-seed round, then they did the Series A, and now it's 5 years later, and you're investing in the Series B, for example, from the same fund. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's crystal clear. I appreciate the color there. I have a question about the tokens versus equity idea we just mentioned here. The tokens that you might get if you're investing in some altcoin or some protocol is almost instantly unlocked sometimes. Sometimes there's a short holding period, but typically you get liquidity pretty quickly. Do you think that that is a disadvantage for some of those companies and founders building that they don't have that long-term focus and long-term requirement to sit around for a decade and build, and you know, they have this kind of like easy out where they can sell at any time? Is that, do you think that's a meaningful disadvantage?
It depends on what they're trying to optimize for. So maybe it's an advantage if they are mercenaries, right? And they're trying to optimize for their own ROI, which is fair, as long as that's something that's disclosed to other stakeholders. If they are missionaries, or if they're a mix between the two, then I think it could be a disadvantage, actually. And that's because the rest of their network, both their community that holds tokens, as well as the investors to whom they issue tokens, are, you know, not incentivized long-term partners. And that's different in venture capital. So what a Bitcoin or Lightning founder should expect when they take capital, either from a Bitcoin VC fund or a generalist fund, is they should expect that those founders are partners for them over the long term. So that means over 10 years. And in 10 years, you're going to have both ups and downs. And, you know, mature, good VCs should be with you through those ups and downs. I'm not sure that those, and part of that is because everyone is economically incentivized in the same way, which is that your equity becomes valuable and also becomes liquid, more liquid, when the enterprise value of the company increases. And so everyone has sort of the same economic incentives, and that can be meaningful. And venture capital, of course, you know, has a multi-decade history of working in this way. And I do think that the alignment of economic incentives are, you know, a major part of that.
Right. Now, another angle, like, because there's short lockup periods in altcoin stuff, I think it's gotten a lot of capital flowing in the last year or two. And I think a lot of the Bitcoin companies are relatively, like, you know, you mentioned to it earlier that they're like relatively underappreciated or underinvested in, and they're just kind of like this hidden gem that they've got a lot of traction and adoption. There's a big user base, but maybe they don't have as much capital. Do you get the sense that Bitcoin innovation and adoption is at all constrained by capital today? Is that something we need to get more people investing in? And would it make adoption faster if we had more money flowing into Bitcoin? Or specifically,
that's
Bitcoin
a really
company?
Good question. Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm not sure. So I think that, what do we think about that? So I think that where there's the greatest constraint around capital for Bitcoin companies now is probably Series A or Series B stage. And the strongest companies in a traditional sense, so I mean companies that have a growing user base, whose revenue is growing, who have been able to achieve milestones on their roadmap, those companies can still access capital, including from top-tier VC funds, classic top-tier VC funds, and that's going to change over time. Our portfolio, the companies I work most closely with, which include both companies in our portfolio and companies outside of the portfolio, they themselves have been able to access capital appropriately. I do think that there could be more experimentation at the very early stage. So in the pre-seed sort of idea generation stage, if there was more capital in the space. But as you mentioned, I believe a few minutes ago, there have been new Bitcoin venture funds coming into the ecosystem. And so I think the early stage capital problem has been mostly resolved at this point. And now it's making sure that companies that are growing are really prepared for the challenge that it is to raise a later stage financing, where your metrics are key to the success of your funding round.
Right. Now, on the other hand of that issue, is there a fear or a concern that if inflation runs hot, if Bitcoin starts to have another real big cycle and people get really excited about it, that there could be too much capital being pumped into some of these companies? And how do you then react if that happens, you know, to be?
Okay, so let's see. So when a founder is raising capital, what's important is that they're thinking about the roadmap of consecutive financings. And so while, you know, it's tempting to sort of optimize for the round at hand, you want to think about that in relation to subsequent financing. So what I mean by that is, and to put it in context with your question, when more capital comes into the startup ecosystem, what can happen is there can be competition for a particular investment or a set of investments that results in increasing the valuation of that financing round, which can be a positive thing for a founder if the net effect of that is to reduce their dilution. Higher valuation, raising the same amount of capital, less dilution for the founder. Now, the challenge of that is to think about that in context. If you're a founder in that fortunate position, the challenge is to think about that in context of future financings. So if you raise at X dollars today, will you be able to achieve the metrics that are required to hit a valuation of 2 to 3X your current valuation? And if not, what does that mean about the dilution that happens in aggregate across all of those rounds? So when we're working with founders, we're trying to work with them in a way that minimizes their dilution in the aggregate versus in any one specific round. I know that I said a lot there, so let me pause to see if that made sense or if there's anything I can explain.
Yeah, no, 100%. So founders, you want to make sure that they are optimizing for the least amount of dilution over the duration of the full raise cycle or whatever that cycle is, if it's 10 mm-hmm. years to get acquired or to go public.
Right.
Is that the idea that you want to make sure that they're optimized for the long haul?
Right, exactly. And if there's a lot of capital competing for the same opportunities, what can happen is that valuations can get too high so that a founder can't raise an up round and then subsequent round. And it's not just important as a vanity metric to raise an up round. It's important in order to, sort of preserve the founder's ownership and to avoid significant dilution, really, in subsequent financings. But what I've seen, frankly, from founders in the Bitcoin space is that people are long-term thinkers. Of course, that's the nature of being in Bitcoin, right? And so actually, if they're evaluating multiple term sheets, they're thinking about the long-term. They're thinking about who they want on their board, which is tied to the term sheet that they accept, or they're thinking about who they want their partner to be, who they want to help build the syndicate for that round, all of those sorts of things. And so I think that in Bitcoin, there's probably less of a risk of too much capital in the space because founders tend to be much longer term thinkers and very thoughtful in how they put together a financing and how they frankly add people to their cap table, how they're very thoughtful about who they're selling ownership of the company to, as they should be.
Right. It seems like in the broader venture capital space, something like a down round is like a really, really bad thing. Like that's just the impression I get that people try to, at all costs, avoid that down round. Is that the same, do you think, in the Bitcoin space? Like with this long-term mindset, do you think investors are more willing to support a company through a down round, or is that an issue as well, do you think?
Well, both in Bitcoin and in the traditional space, founders can have a very successful outcome in the long term with the company, even if they've had to go through a down round. However, down rounds should be avoided because they're very dilutive to founders. And like I said, we want to think about preserving a founder's ownership of a company for as long as we can. And so we do want to avoid down rounds. And we think about that when Stillmark is leading a round. So Stillmark can both lead a round and offer a term sheet, or we can co-lead, or we can just join a round that already has a lead. And all those things are, you know, completely fine with me. They match our portfolio construction model, all of that. But when we're leading a round, we're thinking a lot about what the company is going to need to do to get to an up round in their next financing, and making sure that the valuation of the company and the current financing gives the founder the capability to do what they need to do to hit the next number. And that's really not because we're worried about a down round. From our perspective, we have to worry about that, of course, but it's the first concern is that a founder continues to maintain the ownership that we think is right for them to have throughout cycles of the market and throughout cycles of the company, frankly. And so that's why it's important to get the price right in a current round. Now, you talked about, by the way, Bitcoin has a much shorter history than tech and venture investing, right? And so Bitcoin doesn't yet have the stories of companies that have gone through various sort of fundraising cycles and have made it through like the trenches and the hard work and like dug themselves out of a difficult spot. We have companies that have done that. It's just that they've not gotten to the state where they're talking about it yet. But in the traditional tech worlds, we do have stories like that. And so you can see examples of good VCs working with portfolio founders, their portfolio founders, even during really hard times and down rounds, including multiple down rounds, and then the company having an IPO exit, for example, that was really positive for the founder and also for the VCs. And so, you know, any situation really can be mitigated. The negative consequence of it can be mitigated if founders are working with the right people or have enough experience independently on their own to sort of navigate through. So, you know, that's something I think that differentiates Stillmark, actually, that because I've been in venture for a decade and have experience working with probably like several hundred companies closely, we've seen founders go through and been at the side working with founders going through really exciting, promising times and then really rough times. And none of that is anxiety provoking for us. And also on the positive. So when a company has a huge win, we don't think that means that, you know, everything will be, you know, like unicorns and pixie dust for the rest of the way. We've seen more than that. And so we, you know, I think that the reaction is, you know, always to think about the long term, celebrate the wins with founders, but also not be anxious when it's a rougher time.
Do you think that because Bitcoin has only been around for a little over a decade, that maybe that's an advantage or an opportunity for you because there isn't that, you know, there aren't those like case studies of companies going to $1 trillion valuations like we have with Apple, Amazon, Google, and we don't have that proof yet. And do you think that gives you an opportunity to then invest at a lower valuation because most of the other tech investors are focused on things that have proven out to be, you know, these massive $1 trillion opportunities?
So we want to invest at just a fair valuation, not a lower valuation. But really, of course, we are partnering with founders that should be and able to lead deals in companies that, you know, Sequoia and Kleiner Perkins and Benchmark, you know, the blue chip funds that are thought of as the top 10 generalist funds, they should be leading the deals that we are leading. But they're distracted. They're distracted by altcoins. They're distracted by, you know, WorldCoin. They're distracted by, I forget the name of it, like that social media scraper company.
Yeah.
You know, so they're... Yes, I will probably remember by the end of our discussion. But anyhow, I think that they are the flashy object, of course, is what you can do with the token and what can happen when you can separate your own returns from enterprise value. So what they can do is they can get a quicker cycle on their capital. They can produce, you know, sort of a shorter investment period. That is very appealing for their own investors. And so that's the shiny object right now. However, investors, both family offices, institutions, they do care about what they're backing, about the change that they're supporting in the world. And I think that's where some of these funds that are distracted by the shiny object over the long term are going to have trouble.
If you were speaking to one of these funds that is distracted by the shiny object right now, how do you pitch them on Bitcoin? What do you say to get them to change their mind?
I mean, so I have spoken with many of these sorts of funds. And you asked at the very beginning of our conversation, you know, what Stillmark emerged from. I used to think that I would join one of these funds and work on their Bitcoin investments. And then, you know, 2017, 2018, I realized, you know what, these funds, these particular general partners at these funds who have built their careers in a different paradigm, where the centralization of resource and data and power and the ability to dictate the rules for others has been really important in forming monopoly power, basically, within a sector. That's different now with Bitcoin and with Lightning. And I realized in 2017 and 2018 that the VCs that had built their careers on that dynamic were not going to adopt to Bitcoin and to Lightning. They were not going to grok it. And so I was not going to join one of those funds. Instead, if I was going to continue doing this work and be able to do it in the Bitcoin space, I was going to have to start my own firm. And so that's what Stillmark started from. That was the reason why Stillmark launched. So, you know, there is an opportunity, I suppose, in people being distracted. I initially had hoped that people, you know, that we could like teach people, but I think it's about a new generation of investors coming up, including at those established firms, and getting Bitcoin for themselves. Unfortunately, if there was something I could do to accelerate it, I would. I have tried. If you have ideas, let me know. We're not sort of trying to like hold, you know, like the secrets. You know, we're not trying to like hold the key to the castle. We're happy to help others ramp up in the space.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think there's that saying on Twitter that everyone buys Bitcoin at the price they deserve. And I think that rings true with a lot of what you're saying right now. Real quick. So we talked about monopoly just now and how like some investors are keen to like get into companies that have that monopoly power and to that can kind of like control a segment of an industry. For many people, Bitcoin is like a tool to disintermediate, whether that's banks, payment processors, tech giants, and therefore it kind of like offers that a way to opt out of monopolies. Does the fact that that offers a way out of monopolies hurt the prospect of investing in companies because none of those companies can now command this monopoly power that a bank or a payment processor or a tech giant could have before Bitcoin?
But what they can do is they can access a broader audience. So for instance, Lightning Labs promotes L&D implementation of Lightning Network. These are open source protocols. We never expect for any one implementation to sort of have, you know, the totality of the network. But that doesn't take anything away from Lightning Labs' ability to build products that enable people to have better optimization of their experience on Lightning Network, thus Loop and Pool, for instance. So, and because these are open source protocols that can't be gated, the user group that Lightning Labs can serve with Loop and Pool is much broader than it otherwise be. It would otherwise be, because they're not sort of mitigated by who the banks allow to access the tech in a way that a PayPal would be, or any sort of other payments company, where in order to access that payments company, you need to have an existing banking relationship or have access to a credit card. A company like Lightning Labs doesn't have that same constraint. And so while they may not be able to take a monopoly on the Lightning network, and of course they wouldn't want to, they will be able to have a broader addressable audience because participation in the technology that they promote is not gated. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, it does. So it's kind of a trade-off then. Is it fair to say that maybe the profit margin for some of these like Bitcoin versions of a fiat business will be lower, but that the addressable market will be much larger and kind of compensate for that?
Well, I don't think that's always true. So here's another example. So Stackwork, for instance, is promoted by a company called LND Work. LND Work also advances Sphinx Chat, which you might be familiar with. What Stackwork does is it aggregates a distributed workforce, mostly in emerging markets, to complete tasks for companies, SMBs or enterprise, that have data-driven tasks that can be done on a smartphone. And so an example of that would be perhaps a machine learning company that wanted to be able to discern which of these set of pictures had a pet in it and which didn't have a pet in it. So that's work that can be done on a smartphone. The companies will bring that work to Stackwork, and it's distributed to a workforce that can be distributed because they can be paid in Lightning. So their competitors can do something similar, but the workforce has to be aggregated so that the payment of that workforce can be done efficiently because it's not done via Lightning. So does Stackwork have a lower, is their business model impaired in any way? Absolutely not. Actually, they've created a business model that it's completely consistent with Lightning Network and with Bitcoin principles. And they can create the same margin on their offering as a competitor could. It's just that they can do so more efficiently by leveraging Lightning Network. So I think that there are different dynamics at play for different sorts of companies. And I think the potential of a company that's operating in the Bitcoin space consistent with Bitcoin principles and protocols has a larger addressable market and thus a bigger TAM, total addressable market in terms of dollars, and thus has an even larger exit opportunity terminal value for the company than would a company operating in any other space.
Okay. Now, if there's a world where there's 10 different Stackworks, all on Lightning, all competing against each other. Mm-hmm. Do you think that reduces their gross margins? Like that now there's...
Well, that reduces the gross margins of any company.
So I guess my question would be like, what are some of the moats that you're seeing in Bitcoin that can protect a company from competition in the same way that like a monopoly in Web2 can protect that business from competition?
Okay, so in web, so competition in Web2, in our space, in any space, is always going to have some disadvantages for folks in the field, and also perhaps some advantages. It can, help market the category, for example. It can also be offered as a proof point that there is actually value in that category, which can be helpful for fundraising, for example. But competition, of course, does have a consequence on one's business. And in a free and open market, that's what we expect. Now, the opportunity in the Bitcoin space at this time is that because there's so much green space that's undeveloped, is that many types of companies can get a run at a category without having competition. So we can use Stackwork as an example. Casa, when it was founded, Casa really introduced the concept of be your own bank, have a bank in your back pocket. And now that there's competition, does that impair Casa in any way? Honestly, I don't think so. And here's why. It's because we are still, it's still about expanding the category. And there are so many folks that still need to be served by a be your own bank software solution, that there's a ton of room to grow, even if there's multiple companies competing for the same sort of value proposition, to offer the same value proposition. But for Bitcoin and for Lightning, there's an opportunity now to launch something first and to get, you know, 6 months, a year, 18 months in market with your consumer base without having competition. And of course, and so one of the things that people have said about Bitcoin and about entrepreneurs in the Bitcoin space is that it's harder to build in Bitcoin than it is to build in Ethereum or Solana, where there might be more developed developer tools. However, one of the benefits of that is that there's going to be less competition if you are building in the space. And so for a lot of reasons, I think it's a really appealing time for entrepreneurs to be building in Bitcoin and Lightning.
Right.
Including that there's less competition.
And I guess one other benefit. Well, one other benefit could also be that in other chains, you see people who are start on Ethereum, they go to some layer two, they go build their own chain, and they kind of have to switch their focus over time as the environment mm-hmm. changes. But if you're building on Bitcoin, if you're building on Lightning, it's kind of like a foundation you can always trust and right. count on. You know, it's a solid foundation.
Right. I've talked about that a lot. So there's less, you know, reason to expect that you'll need to do a deep refactor if you're building on Bitcoin than if you're building on another tech. And by the way, we do often have the opportunity to talk to founders that are building in other environments like Ethereum or Solana. And many, many of those founders are building on them until there's an opportunity to build it somewhere else in a more stable environment, including on Bitcoin or Lightning. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm, you know, so bullish on the meme of if it can be built on Bitcoin, it will. I see that in the founder conversations I'm having, that no one, frankly, is building on Ethereum because they, you know, love the dynamic changing environment of the Ethereum protocol and the promise of a fundamental change to consensus, right? No founder is looking for that specifically. They're building there because there's certain things that they can do now that they maybe can't do in other environments. And I think when they can do that in other environments, many will switch. The folks that can switch will likely switch.
Right. Do you think today we're, as a community, as a Lightning community, Bitcoin community, investing enough in building that infrastructure that will enable some of these new use cases and enable people to move from other chains back to Bitcoin?
I think so. I mean, of course, I would love to see, you know, even more of an emphasis put on creating developer tools and education that can allow people to build, you know, in the Bitcoin space more robustly. But frankly, I think that we have a lot of talent in the space. People have switched. So the example that I love to reference is Atomic Finance, because they started off in the Ethereum space. They're funded by, you know, Ethereum folks. And yet when they found an opportunity to move over to Bitcoin, that's what they did. And they're very clear and thoughtful in the reasons why. You know, I think that if we open the door for more of that, I think that people are working on that, but not that specifically. People are working on lowering the barrier to entry to building in Bitcoin or building on Lightning. And that's incredibly bullish, and I'm excited for all of that. But nonetheless, the entrepreneurial talent that exists in the space now is sufficient. I mean, there's hundreds of promising companies that are progressing products in the marketplace now, and you know, I suppose in the future there'll be thousands, but hundreds is quite enough. It keeps us busy. And yeah, I mean, the advantage, like I said before, is that I think there's an opportunity for founders to face less competition today than they otherwise would. And in the future, that will change.
Now, one thing that I guess when an application is built on Bitcoin, if you have enough of them, it starts to grow the addressable market for Bitcoin. It mm-hmm. eventually leads to growing the price of Bitcoin and adoption of it. Do you think that some of the large Bitcoin holders, like I'm talking like MicroStrategy or Tesla or some of the people who have come out and said publicly, like, we own tens of thousands of coins or hundreds of thousands. Do you think they should be investing in building some of these applications or building infrastructure? Do you think that's like a good risk management approach when you do have such?
Do you mean like the Square or the Block model?
Yeah, I mean specifically thinking of MicroStrategy, but it could be anyone really. Like, do you think it's important that they're funding some of these infrastructure projects? I know Spiral is doing a bunch of work tied to Square loosely, but how important do you think it is that large kind of holders of Bitcoin are funding and kind of like adding value to the infrastructure or applications being built on Bitcoin?
You know, I mean, I'm a venture capitalist, so I think it's important. But I also think that everyone, the beauty of Bitcoin is that it's permissionless in all directions. And so people choose how to participate. Simply holding Bitcoin is more than adequate. MicroStrategy, as an example, of course, does much, much more than that. But even if they were just holding Bitcoin, that's more than sufficient. And they've had an incredible impact on the ecosystem. You know, I do think it's an advantage in the Bitcoin space, in the altcoin space, and in tech in general, when folks that have built and accumulated wealth in that arena then give back. And they can give back really just by investing. So it's actually not giving back. It's just putting capital to work to help continue to grow folks building at the frontier of the space. That's something that Silicon Valley actually talks a lot about. So for instance, the PayPal Mafia, well, first of all, it's called the PayPal Mafia, not just because these are executives that helped build and grow PayPal, but because they went out to form other companies together or to invest in other founders together collaboratively in a way that really resulted in a sort of explosion of innovation and of growth in the tech field. We've seen attempts to replicate that in altcoin ecosystems with massive altcoin dedicated funds for founders building in those spaces, including in the Ethereum space. And in Bitcoin, we've seen less of that. You know, I suppose, I don't know, like I said, I'm a venture capitalist. So from my seat, of course, I would love to see smarter capital for companies in the space, meaning, you know, if we have someone that is putting capital into the space and they have been in Bitcoin for X number of years and sort of really understand the underlying tech and the promises that it promotes, then that capital may come attached to advice or insight that's valuable for investors or for builders. And I think that the ecosystem is advantaged on the occasions that that occurs and would be further advantaged if it occurred more frequently.
Interesting. So do you think there's this Bitcoin mafia forming of people who have invested in the protocol and may see gains mm-hmm. there and then fund companies as a result with that kind of gain that they made investing in the protocol?
Yeah, I would not use the mafia word, of course. And I didn't think it felt slanderous for the PayPal Mafia. But here, I suppose, I think that people in Bitcoin are generally not traveling in packs. I think that we have a lot of independent thinkers that have created family offices and you know, incredible wealth by being early and bullish on Bitcoin. And also, you know, advantage that they could hold their Bitcoin over the long term, able to properly secure their Bitcoin, all of that, all of the challenges that come with being early to Bitcoin, and are also investing in startups in the ecosystem. And Stillmark's initial capital, the way that the Stillmark Fund launched, was with those sorts of backers.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. How do you think about, when you're thinking about investing in founders, how important is it to you? Well, first, let's say, how important is it that you're investing in the right founder versus the right product? But then also on the founder side, how important is it that they have a deep understanding of Bitcoin versus maybe they have a deep understanding of tech and they're just plugging into Bitcoin, using it as like a tool, but not building on Bitcoin? Like how do you kind of think about which founders to invest in?
Well, we invest in founders building companies in what we perceive to be in the future very large markets. So, you know, and we also have invested in a broad diversity of founders. So we've invested, in founders based in the United States, across the United States, also international founders. We've invested in, there's a lot of different sorts of founders that we invest in. However, what's consistent is that these are generally folks that are missionaries for Bitcoin and recognize the opportunity to, while providing value, also capture some of that value for the company. So their company is not managed as a nonprofit. It's managed as a company that can be a big business and likely a public business at some point. They're folks that can catalyze others to come work with them, which is an incredible skill, because when you're working with a startup company, you essentially have a portfolio of one, right? So we talked before about Stillmark portfolio, 15 to 20 companies for the first fund. But when you're working for a startup, your portfolio is just one, just that startup. And so a founder's ability to sell the vision to the best engineers, to the best sales folks, the best customer service folks, that's really important. Their ability to be calm throughout all sorts of circumstances, or at least grounded. So in a 10-year journey, even in a shorter journey, so in your first couple years of founding a company, there's going to be great euphoric moments, and then there's going to be, you know, extended periods of time that are really difficult. And to want to do that is odd. And so, you know, a founder, it's important though that founders are odd in that way. And some of the founders that we work with are just have that ability to do it because they're doing it for Bitcoin or to drive Bitcoin's adoption, to enable many, many billions of people to have access to free and fair finance. And that's the reason why they're able to tolerate sort of the ups and downs of building a company. So that's what we're looking for. But that said, you specifically asked about understanding Bitcoin. And one of the changes that Stillmark is expecting to see in the next few years is that the sorts of founders building in the Bitcoin and Lightning space will become more diverse, and that not everyone will be an expert in Bitcoin. You will also have people that are experts in their domain and recognize the opportunity in Bitcoin. So an example could be in the gaming space. And we have backed folks like this. So our investment in PinkFrog that I talked about, these founders come from King, which is a top global studio, one of the top studios in the world. And they prior built Candy Crush. They built it to 100 million daily active users. They know how to build games. They recognize in Bitcoin a unique opportunity. And they see Bitcoin as inherently different from other altcoins. So they're smart, right? They really get it. I mean, that's an incredible insight to have, by the way, when you're inundated, as most people are, by media that says that Ethereum and Solana is what's interesting, right? And so I don't know that the founders would define themselves when they started as experts in Bitcoin or Lightning, but they knew, because they weren't as expert in that as they were in gaming, that they wanted to have an investor with them that could expand their network there and bring experts on board. So I don't mean directly on board to the team, but on board to what they were doing and building, so that they weren't, you know, so that they had all the advantages of what Bitcoin did, and that they were also operating in a way that was consistent with Bitcoin and Lightning. And that's how Stillmark will get involved with some of those projects, by the way, because they will reach out to someone that can, you know, be their Lightning expert for them as they're in that ramp up phase. And then they're down the rabbit hole, right? But anyhow, that's one example. I think there will be many more. So there will be experts in fields that recognize something in Bitcoin, that want to apply Bitcoin to drive value in their business and for their users. And Bitcoin will be massively benefited by that. And so Stillmark, of course, is looking to work with founders in that group as well.
And now, as you progress through rounds with a founder or with a company, how does the mix between, like, a founder's character and the market and the revenue of the business, does that mix change at all over time? Because I imagine at the earliest stage, it's very important to have a founder with the characteristics you're looking for, someone who's you know, odd in that particular way, that is willing to commit to a long period of you know, working through all the struggles of building a business. But how does that change over time? And at what point do you start to think about like the actual business metrics? Are they hitting the targets? How important does that become as you progress from like a pre-seed round to a Series A to a Series B?
I think that's important in the seed round. So in the pre-seed round, it can be more of an idea and you know, just starting to build the product. Also, R&D happens, you know, at and after pre-seed rounds. And then once you get to a seed round, early metrics are important. And early metrics can look like, you know, we sold this software to one SMB and they found it valuable and they're willing to provide a reference for us. It can be just that. It could be that you have your first group of 20 to 30 users using the product and that you understand from those 20 to 30 users that once you're onboarded, you know, about half of the people that onboard will actually be active each month. It could be just that, but understanding early product market fit very early. So, you know, is there something here that people will find valuable and is that quantifiable in the earliest way? I think that becomes important as early as seed stage. Now, that's not always true, but it's usually true. So there's exceptions to that for sure. There are companies that raise while they're still doing raise seed rounds or even Series A rounds while they're still doing R&D and haven't done any sales or onboarded any users. But those are the exceptions. And so when you ask a general question like that, I want to, you know, provide really sort of what the rule is versus the exceptions to the rule.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, I want to dive into specific Bitcoin applications. And one of the ones you mentioned earlier was payments, that you're excited about. The payments, this was going to be the big year for payments. Can you speak to the particular kinds of payments that you're most excited about? Is this stuff happening like in retail settings? Is this online payments? Is this like in-game payments? Any particular vertical of payments that you're most excited about?
Well, all of what you said. Also, I've been talking for a while about earning. We're seeing earning happen in some of the ways that you just described, actually, and in others. I talked before about stack work, paying a distributed workforce, and Lightning. Another thing that Stack Work and Sphinx Chat actually is doing is allowing people to release and pay bounties via sats in their workforce marketplace. So that you can say, you know, hey guys, I need this feature to be built, or I'd like you to, you know, test the security of this code, and then pay them in sats and discover them in a distributed way because we're using Lightning for the payment. Earning obviously can happen through rewards, like a Fold is advancing and others. Gaming is a really great example that I like because of the different demographics that I believe will onboard to Bitcoin through gaming. And then I think just, you know, payments is, we think of payments as a singular thing, but it's really not. Payments is, you know, almost everything you touch has an element of payments to it. And so I think that Bitcoin will start to sort of weave its way into the world, the online world, in a similar way to the meme of software is eating the world. Lightning will progress in that same way. And what that will mean is that people will onboard to Bitcoin in a way where they're really excited about the value of their sats in Bitcoin. But it also means that people will use Lightning without knowing that they're using Bitcoin or having any sort of expectation that the sats they're exchanging appreciate in value. It will sort of be something neutral to them. And I think that we'll see that in Lightning this year for the year of payments. I think that we will see a separation. We will see payments be appreciated as Bitcoin payments, but we will also see Lightning Network be appreciated as a protocol for technology, as a technology. Even if there's not an expectation that there'll be a return on investment of the asset traded.
Now, do you think some of this lightning adoption that we see this year is going to come from, like, do you think the majority of it comes from people earning Bitcoin versus buying it? Because that seems to me like it's one of the features that separate Bitcoin from a lot of other protocols, is that there's now avenues for people to earn it. And it's really taking on a role mm-hmm. of money in smaller kind of in subsegments of the online world. And it's now becoming, there's meaningful ways you can actually earn it instead of, you know, you have to go to an exchange, you have to buy it, or you have to, it's buy and sell for most assets. Whereas Bitcoin, it's now you can earn, you can spend, you can pay, you can save, you can do a bunch of different things with the asset.
Right, exactly. And it changes the motivation of why people are coming on board. So I've talked about that a lot. We started with people participating in Bitcoin as a way to invest or as a hedge against their exposure to their local fiat currency or to speculate. And in other spaces, in altcoin spaces, people, I think, participate to invest for ROI, to speculate, or to gamble. So it's different. But Bitcoin is moving past that now. And so what's happening is that people are joining Bitcoin because they've earned it. And there's such a broad array of ways to do that. So we talked about some of the things that are like way out there, right? Like bug bounties or just a bounty for building a feature of a product. But by the way, you can also be mining to earn Bitcoin. And that's another way to earn it. And it's easier to mine today as an individual, to participate in mining today as an individual, than it was just a couple years ago. And so there's this really broad array of how people can participate in Bitcoin, and it will make them as a class different in motivation from those that joined to hedge their risk to their from their local governments or to invest. And I expect that, you know, I expect that it will have very broad repercussions, including that it can change the way that Bitcoin trades, because the sort of variables that are important in determining Bitcoin's fundamental value, or the reason why people would buy and sell Bitcoin, will have been expanded, which will decrease the significance of the driving variables that we see today. So this will take a long time to mature. I'm not proposing that the consequences are felt, you know, in 2022 or 2023, but we're on a road in that direction, and that will, you know, largely be through earning.
Right. Yeah, I'm very excited about earning as well. I've played around with a few Lightning apps, and this podcast is actually a Lightning podcast, and so I've seen that mm-hmm. transition in the last few months of earning hundreds of sats a day to now earning thousands through the podcast. I've seen transitions on things like Stacker News, where, you know, maybe I was earning 10 sats a day posting stuff a couple months ago, and now it's, you know, dozens or hundreds of sats. You can kind of see how quickly
that's awesome.
That change is happening. And I mean, yeah, it's, you know, 1,000 sats or a couple thousand sats is only $1. But you take another 10X and all of a sudden 10 bucks mm-hmm. a post or 10 bucks a podcast, or you start to get into meaningful numbers mm-hmm. for a chunk of the population. And then you take it 10X from there. And it's like, it's really meaningful for a lot of people. So I'm very excited about that as well.
That's awesome. Exciting to hear. It's exciting to hear real feedback and experience of that. And I imagine it's really exciting for you to be a pioneer, like a first user of something like that. And I'm excited for people going through that experience in general. So for instance, I know that Substack allowed not only for content to be paid in Bitcoin in 2021 and in the going forward, but also allowed authors, content creators to receive in Bitcoin. And so I think that, you know, what feels just like a fun experiment or a game for someone that might be less sophisticated in Bitcoin than you are can turn into something more than that when you start to, you can be hooked by the price or by the game of it. And then sort of come to understand the value of Bitcoin. And by the way, that's what we saw. That's how Bitcoin started out. You know, mining back in 2009, you know, probably felt like an exploration or a game to most people. And then it became a hobby, and then it became a profession. And now we have, you know, mining companies that are public. I think that that same progression will be felt by folks earning sats.
Right. And right now it seems like a lot of the avenues you can earn sats on, specifically creating content on Stacker News or podcasting, those are probably the two that I've had most success with in playing around with different Lightning apps. Those are both basically like they're better in every way from the alternative. Like on Reddit, you get upvotes. It's like, who cares? And then on, you know, a podcasting platform, this podcast goes out to Spotify and Apple as well. It goes out everywhere. It doesn't interfere with any other form of monetization. There's no paywall. Anyone can listen. And you can also earn sats. So it's like, there's just an added benefit. And there's basically no, it doesn't take away at all from the experience, which is really cool to see. And I hope we get a bunch more Bitcoin companies finding ways to just create experiences that are just better and don't have to rely on, like, you know, it's a product for Bitcoiners. It's just a product that's better, you know?
Yes, I think that'd exactly. be
a really cool inflection point to see. But I want to transition a bit to like Web3, because we've danced around the topic of like online payments, and we've talked about gaming, and there's this big broad term that I don't know anyone really knows what it means. Web3, or I guess everyone has a different definition of it. Maybe we can start with like what Web3 means to you, and what you think Bitcoin's role might be in that next iteration.
Sure. I mean, I was going to ask you that. So I thought you were going to ask a question about Web3, and then I was going to ask you to define it for me, and then I was going to respond. You know, I mean, I guess I don't think about Web3 at all. I don't think about Web3 at all. You know, I think a nice thing about Bitcoiners is that, and also it's probably to our judgment, but we don't care about buzzwords, right? I don't. It's probably to our detriment because buzzwords are buzzy for a reason. And so we should probably start naming our, you know, things we do and protocol upgrades to something that's catchier. But anyhow, I don't think about Web3 at all. I don't know what it means. You know, because I think what it means is right now, today. It could mean something different in the future. But I think what it means in Q1 2022 is I'm trying to trick you. That's what I think it means. So I think it's something that people say when they want to encourage folks to be excited without feeling empowered to understand what they're excited about. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So, you know, no one around me says Web3. I don't know what it means. I see it, you know, I understand that Facebook is now Meta because they're going Web3, or I don't know. I think it means either there's an internal confusion or an intent to confuse. That's how I interpret it when people say it now.
That's fair. Yeah. I think there's a lot of people in altcoin communities that have that exact vision you just described. I think there's also a group of Bitcoiners that define it differently and just view it as a different thing.
Okay.
But I don't know that there's a correct definition or one that's like accepted.
Well,
everywhere.
What is the Bitcoin definition of Web3?
I mean, I think that there's a movement. If you maybe think about it, instead of Web3, maybe the way to think about it is like a next iteration of the internet. And I think the Bitcoiner ethos here is like towards self-sovereign computing, owning your own, like, personal servers, using something like an Umbral, or owning your data and being able to, like, make payments natively on the internet, I think is the idea behind a lot of...
So in terms of being able to make payments natively on the internet, Lightning is obviously progressing to serve that function broadly.
I agree. Yeah.
When we talk to potential investors or investors about what we're doing, what everyone is universally excited about, whether or not they know anything about Bitcoin or hold Bitcoin, is the ability to send money across the globe whenever they want to, without needing their bank's permission. And now I'm talking about, you know, folks that run large family offices in the US, you know, endowments, institutions, all folks that are in traditional business. For instance, I had one investor say to me, you know, my daughter is at school in the UK. This weekend, she needed money. She lost her banking card and she needed money for the weekend. And I could not send her a wire because my bank was closed. And I would have loved if I was able to send her money through Bitcoin, through Lightning. They said through Lightning, actually. And so people get it. There's an acute pain point that Lightning can address. And that acute pain point is very broad. Everyone feels it. People that are very privileged feel it. People that are very poor feel it also. And, you know, Lightning is there. Lightning was really tested and successfully so last year. It succeeded in its testing in El Salvador. And I expect that 2022, we will see the consequence of that, which is a broader adoption of Lightning.
Right.
Now, and of Bitcoin through Lightning.
How far do you think Lightning's reach can expand on the internet? Like in a mature state, maybe a decade from now, are all social media apps plugging into Lightning? Are all, is LinkedIn plugging into Lightning to make, you know, searching for a job easier people put advertisements up through Lightning?
So LinkedIn will plug into Lightning in this way. So you will be able to tokenize and prove your participation in something through a token that is issued on Lightning or on Liquid or Lightning on Liquid in a way that you have a record of participation that cannot be falsified or alternatively that can be verified, that can be technically verified. Now, I think something that I'm excited about for Bitcoin right now, and I suppose this could change, it's different from the altcoin space, is that when folks are building in Lightning, because there's so, or Bitcoin, there's so much to do, there's so much value, like true value to add, there's so many ways to address acute pain points that people are mostly not doing frivolous stuff. So this is not about trying to think about, you know, how to monetize, you know, every time someone looks at your JPEG, are you getting 25 cents for it? You know, I mean, I don't know, like, could Lightning do that? Like, of course, it can do that. Are people like talking about that and selling that? You know, there's a lot of other things to do right now. So I think that Lightning will be completely integrated into people's experience online and offline, by the way, both. And my hope is that we are really focused on doing so in a way that reduces friction for people, you know, and makes things more accessible versus the opposite. And if we sort of like over monetize each aspect of our day, like what if people had to pay to look at this JPEG? You know, I don't know. I mean, is that something that makes sense as a way to spend your time? I don't know. We don't talk to many of those people.
Finding ways.
It's more about finding true intrinsic value by solving real pain, not creating new sorts of pain by imagining everything in the world that you can monetize. I think that's very, I don't know, unsophisticated, frankly. And it's not something that we, you know, it's really characteristic of altcoin spaces right now, where people are imagining how to monetize every little thing. What if we force people to pay for X, Y, and Z? Okay.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's like once they discover they can build a token or create a token, they're just finding ways to shove a token in different use cases, whether or not it makes sense. Whereas
I'm
saying with Lightning and Bitcoin is that people are first looking for problems that solves.
That actually exists.
Knowing that there's
not
another token to monetize.
People are looking to solve problems that actually exist. And, you know, that will be, you know, the next two decades of Lightning Network and Bitcoin Network entrepreneurship.
Awesome.
And okay, then after that, we can worry about all the frivolous stuff.
Yeah. One final question here. I want a prediction on what application or maybe vertical you think most people, maybe mainstream adoption, will come from in Lightning? So what's going to be that first point of interaction that people have? If we onboard a billion people to Lightning, where do most of those people first interact with Lightning? Where do you think?
Well, you'd have to give me a demographic. It'll depend. So this is like an academic answer. A lot of these folks are going to come from gaming. So if they're Gen Z or young millennials, a lot of people are going to come from gaming. There's, of course, other demographics that are served by gaming. So imagine the Candy Crush audience, which mm-hmm. was not, you know, I don't think it was, it wasn't kids, you know, it was those people will onboard to Bitcoin through earning in gaming, or because they want to tip in their game, or because they want to send a peer-to-peer, you know, like value in the game, which could come in the form of sats directly or something that looks different from sats. So that will onboard, you know, those demographic groups. I think that earning will onboard a ton of people in emerging markets. And that's already started with stack work, like I described before. I think that people will get curious about Bitcoin and maybe want to like tinker around, like sort of engineering and technically minded folks that are late now coming into Bitcoin might come in through mining. Maybe they want to play around with what Compass Mining is doing, you know? Mm-hmm. Or maybe they're buying a home miner directly. So I think that form of earning will be relevant. Technical people are definitely onboarding now through these bounties that I talked about through Sphinx Chat and Stack Work. And that's really exciting to see. So, and then of course, I think actually people just accessing the tech through things they do every day where they don't need Bitcoin, but they need the tech. This is important. If there's like one thing I could leave the audience with, I think we should all be thinking about this. Let's think about who needs the tech that doesn't necessarily need Bitcoin specifically. So who needs access to global payments? Those people are going to be reached through things like remittances and the sort of activity that happened in El Salvador, where people were spending their airdrop, you know, buying food, going to the pharmacy, stuff like that. And one of the things, we didn't talk about it today, but I'll leave this on a final note. One of the things that I'm looking forward to is when stable channels exist in the Lightning Network so that people can transact in USD and make use of Lightning Network without needing to want to tolerate or to be able to tolerate Bitcoin's volatility. And when we're talking about people across socioeconomic statuses, we should not and cannot always be talking about wealthy people or middle class people. We should be talking about everyone. And if you're not wealthy or very securely in the middle class, Bitcoin's volatility is really hard to tolerate. And so stable channels or stable coins on Lightning unlock Lightning and Bitcoin, which is a protocol, in addition to being an asset for everyone. That's exciting. And so people will come on board in all of those ways. They'll come on board through earning, through Lightning, through stable payments, and all of it is equally valid in my mind. I don't think that you must hold Bitcoin in order to be a member of you know, Bitcoin. I think that using Lightning because you need to send your daughter money in the UK on a Sunday is good enough.
Yeah.
And we're going to be onboarding a lot of those people this year.
Love to hear it. Those are great predictions. Great way to end the episode. Real quick, what is the best place that people can reach out to you or learn more about Stillmark?
So we are at stillmark.com online and Hello Stillmark on Twitter and Elise Killeen at Twitter.
Perfect. Thanks so much for taking the time. Really enjoyed this episode.
Awesome, Kevin.
Hope we can do it again soon.
I hope so too. Thank you, Kevin.
Welcome to the Lightning Round presented by Voltage. Voltage is the industry-leading provider of Bitcoin and Lightning node infrastructure. In fact, many of your favorite apps and services already use Voltage to scale their business quickly and easily without maintenance. Voltage also offers an inbound liquidity product called Flow, which helps you as a node operator get inbound liquidity easily. Overall, Voltage is creating the industry standard suite of non-custodial products, helping brands, engineers, and startups scale. To learn more about Voltage, visit voltage.cloud.
All right. In the last week, we've had 13 different supporters send in sats. That's got to be a record high or pretty close to it. Real quick, I'll run through the top five. Jeffrey sent in 4,950 sats. African BLC sent in 4,158 sats. Y sent in 2,574 sats. Niall sent in 2,063 sats. And Carter sent in 1,881 sats. That's the new bar. That's what it takes to break into the top five. That continues to rise. So I appreciate everyone who keeps in sending sats. It looks like 10 different episodes were tipped, or people sent in sats on 10 different episodes, which again is, I believe, another all-time high. And there were 11 messages that came in the last week. Just going to read through them here. First up, we had Jeffrey, who says, "Keep up the great work, Kevin. I learned so much from your show." Thank you, Jeffrey, for the sats and the kind words. African BLC says, "Kevin, you're killing it with your show, becoming a firm favorite of mine. Thank you." African BLC also sent in their Lightning address and would love more content on Lightning addresses, as it's a big unknown for African BLC. And so I appreciate the comment and the sats, African BLC. Thank you for that. Carter sent in a clapping emoji with 1,881 sats. Thank you, Carter. Y sends in a comment on the last episode with Hussein Badakhshani on Noah. And he says, "It sounds convoluted and uninspired so far. Boring DeFi with a non-blockchain token." I think this proof is going to be in the pudding here. I think Noah's trying something unique. They're trying some original approach at building on Bitcoin. And I think we got to see what comes from the actual product once it's released before making judgment on it. But I'm excited to see experimentation in the space overall. We had an anonymous user send in a comment on that same episode. It said, "The innovation coming out of the Lightning space is so inspiring. You're my number one resource for keeping up. Appreciate what you're doing, man." Thank you, anonymous user, for the sats and the comment. Raven sends a comment and says, "I would like to test a free month of Voltage." And so I sent Raven a coupon code for a free month of Voltage. They included their Twitter handle. So if anyone would like a free month of Voltage, I believe I have one more coupon remaining, maybe two. So if you send in your Twitter handle or your email address, and if it's your Twitter handle, you got to have open DMs so I can reach out to you. But if you send in an email address or a Twitter handle, I will reach out and I will send you a coupon for a free month of Voltage if you'd like to try out the Lightning Network. Other than that, can't wait to see all your comments and questions this week. Would love to know what you think of today's episode. If you'd like future guests, if you'd like to request guests, you can send in comments about that too. And I look forward to reading all your comments and questions next week.